Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Cultures of Ideas in the Knowledge Society. I'm Henrietta Moore, I'm Deputy Director of the LSE, and I'm here to chair this panel this evening and to introduce everyone to you. This evening we are hearing from a team from Bristol University who've been carrying out some research into the LSE and into Demos. Now, this is a rather brave thing, I think, to do in a variety of ways. They're hoping that they will leave here in one piece, so please be kind to them. Now, this is a project which has been funded by the ESRC and is looking at the power of contemporary ideas and circuits of knowledge. Now, I'd like to introduce, first of all, Professor Nigel Thrift from the University of Bristol, who is one of the researchers, and Professor Gregor McLennan, who's also from the University of Bristol. They will be talking about the research first, and then we will hear from Tom Bentley from Demos, and of course from Tony Giddens at the end, who will give concluding comments. Now, the team set out, I think, to look at two areas where they felt that the LSE contributes to the formation and dissemination of ideas. And these are, of course, the Knowledge Society and the Third Way. And they intended to track the way in which the LSE has nurtured an internal culture of ideas, creation and dissemination. And more generally, I suppose, the way it has sought to shape and exemplify a certain contemporary image of the public intellectual. So tonight we're here to hear about this research and to celebrate the way in which we're all innovative and contemporary intellectuals, and I hope that will include me. I'm sure it includes all of you. So first of all, we're going to hear from Professor Nigel Thrift. Nigel, please.
Thank you. What I'm hoping to do is set up some brief prefatory comments, which will last for about 15 minutes or so. And the idea is really to set the scene for the kind of thing that Gregor is then going to talk about, which is some of the findings from the project, some of the preliminary findings, and then going on from that, we'll hear from, if you like, the subject of this research in one way or another. And the way I want to start today is really by going back to Anne Whitehead, who in a whole series of ways wrote in the 1920s and 1930s a series of pieces about universities and what he called organizations of knowledge, which I think still have some relevance today. And you can see there that he says, for example, the proper function of a university is imaginative acquisition of knowledge. Apart from this importance of the imagination, there is no reason why businessmen, I apologize for that, and other professional men should not pick up their facts bit by bit as they want them for particular occasions. A university is imaginative, or it is nothing, at least nothing useful. All kinds of commentators, of course, have expressed reservations about whether this kind of quality of imagination is gradually, if you like, fading from the scene so far as universities and other knowledge-producing organizations are concerned. And usually what they talk about are three different kinds of worries. One of these is quite straightforwardly that the quality of knowledge has somehow been degraded, usually through the influence of commercialism, the speed of circulation of knowledge, the impact of new technologies, or all three. Whatever the case, the impact of these three processes, all of them, if you like, are running down what counts as true knowledge and are returning us, if you like, to almost a kind of pre-literate age. Another reservation follows from that sometimes, and that's the rise of so-called type 2 knowledge systems. What one sees apparently in modern times is a move from type 1 knowledge, which is linear, cleaves to single disciplines, is academic in orientation, and is concentrated in a few institutions, and of course notably the modern university, to a type 2 knowledge system, which is non-linear, transdisciplinary, reflexive, and taking a constellation of knowledge-producing institutions of which the university is only one. And in that kind of type 2 knowledge system, what one finds is a whole series of different kinds of knowledge producers. That's one of the reasons why we took LSE as one case and Demos as another. A third reservation identifies the problem As the proliferation of social science knowledges, which are in truth insubstantial, too much knowledge now exists, which is fly-by-night, and which no longer relates to the important themes of life, and therefore no longer generates or consolidates cultural norms. Much current social science knowledge, for example, so commentators would argue, is just too light and airy. It's akin to a kind of sophisticated gossip. Indeed, it's true to say, I think, that some of us are ourselves kind of rather nostalgic for the days when you could tell proper social theory. It was big, it was ordered, it was downright ambitious to cover the world with its explanations, and at least approximated the consoling certainties of natural science. It's these kinds of reservations and our own unease about the nature of modern universities which led us to propose to the SRC a modest study of two of the key British social science knowledge producers, the LSE on one side and Demos on the other. Two institutions which we thought ought to be very different, but which by rights, according to these kinds of explanations, ought to be moving together in some way or the other. What way exactly, to be determined. So that's, if you like, the preamble to the preamble. What I want to do now is to actually talk about the characteristics of modern knowledge systems as one finds them in the literature and elsewhere. And I have to go quickly through this, of course, and this will, of course, be a kind of approximation of a much longer set of things that one could say. If one looks at modern knowledge systems, I think there are enough things which are changing slowly, but in a quantitative scale, but generally when they're put together to produce a qualitative shift, to suggest that modern solid knowledge systems have become different. One of these characteristics is simply institutional thickness. There are simply many more garlands of knowledge-producing institutions around than there used to be. For example, I pointed to what I've called the cultural circuit of capital, which consists of a self-reproducing set of institutions, university business schools, management consultants, management gurus, and the media, acting to distribute and to actually produce knowledge of various kinds which passes through the business system. And there are many other of these kinds of garlands of institutions which now exist, many of them now, if you like, self-reproducing in quite strong ways. Second major characteristic, which is allied to this, is that simply there are many more knowledge intermediaries than there were. The chain of production, distribution, and consumption of knowledge has lengthened. The whole, if you like, intellectual division of labor in terms of knowledge production has in particular grown longer than it was, because in particular of a whole set of middle-range institutions between weak and strong knowledge producers. And again, we were thinking of Demos here when we were thinking of this. A third major characteristic, as already imputed, has been the rise of the media. The media is pervasive and it acts as a spur to new knowledge in its voracious hunger for new copy and identifiable styles of idea. The idea that we live in a period when there's a yawning gap between social science knowledge and users seems in certain senses quite laughable to us. The problem is rather that most of the time what knowledge circulates is, if you like, so randomly determined. A fourth major characteristic has been the increased speed of circulation of knowledge. And at this point, what one usually finds is that people start to talk about telecommunications, about the internet, about e-learning, and so on and so forth. For various reasons, I personally am profoundly skeptical of these kinds of technical explanations, and yet at the same time, I think they have enabled very traditional forms of knowledge communication, like, for example, the lecture or the seminar or the conference, to be mass-produced in a way that didn't used to be the case in the past. And in a sense, the whole world now is this kind of constant furore of lectures and conferences and seminars, and indeed, there's a massive literature on precisely how to roll these particular institutions out in different kinds of circumstances. A fifth major characteristic is the fact that our theories are playing an increasingly constructive part in how the world is constituted. And Tony Giddens has talked about this in terms of institutional reflexivity, and there have been many other ways in which it's been talked about, I think, recently. I think personally that one of the interesting things is that this is now, in certain senses, being strengthened, in particular by the increasing prevalence of software. Software, much of it now runs on social science theories of one form or another, so that truly the background in which we exist, increasingly, if you like, reflects theories about how the world is. And then finally, there is one more major characteristic. The materializing of ideas has gone on apace. My sense is that the organization of thought, to use Whitehead's term, has become more and more complex. To use Bruno Latour's terminology, there are simply more and more cooking steps in producing knowledge of one form or another. Lots and lots of loops and counterloops, consisting of various kinds of material entities, each with their own presentational and representational biases. Now, many commentators have immediately rushed to judgment on this state of affairs, and they have been sure that what we're seeing is that, in a sense, the quality of knowledge is somehow degrading as a result of all these different kinds of changes, that we live in a speeded up and dumbed down world. The problem is, of course, that most of the time these kinds of commentaries have been based on remarkably little evidence of any kind whatsoever. They've been based on the whole on supposition. And one of the things that our project has therefore been trying to collect is some evidence for some of these kinds of propositions. And the problem in turn has been that we can say that I think that the kinds of problems that one finds in terms of the production and consumption of social science knowledge have themselves changed. What I want to do is just to point to some of these problems, because I think they are themselves a matter of debate, and hopefully we can talk about them in the discussion. The first problem arises out of the fact that other forms of knowledge than the model of science, of course, exist in social science. Whitehead, for example, talked about what he called the minor flashes of short-range intelligence that it was possible to get from what he called a mode of knowledge called historical foresight, which surely must be one of the most powerful modes of social science knowledge there is. The ability to get at least a little ahead of the game at particular points and reflect back upon it. This kind of knowledge, though, that Whitehead refers to, can, of course, quite easily fall back into a slavish tracking of change, so that instead of these flashes of insight, what you get is simply a following of the kind of policy ball around the field. So that's one problem that one faces in terms of social science knowledge. A second closely related problem is the closeness of social science knowledge to the world at large, which means that most social science knowledge, I think, has no real ivory tower qualities left to it at all. It may be neglected, but that, I think, is another thing altogether. Thus, social science knowledge produced by universities routinely breaks out into wider circuits. I don't mean by this, of course, simply the various kinds of policy knowledge. I mean, in particular, social science theories of one form or another. A good example of this, I think, two examples that one can think of recently, that show the way these theories have a tendency to break out and to be circulated. The first of these, of course, the idea of communities of practice, first formulated by Jean Lave and then Etienne Wenger, and the way in which that has been circulated like wildfire through the business community in one form or another. I saw Jean Lave recently, and I think it's true to say that she was totally horrified to see what management had actually done with her set of theories, as they'd instrumentalized them so that they would actually move. The second example, classic sociological come psychological work. Stanley Milgram's original work in the 1960s is brought up to date by Duncan Watts, as well as more conventional network theorists like Mark Grenevetter, on various kinds of social networks and such like. Again, this is now circulating like mad through management forums in one way or another. Again, what's interesting is the way in which these ideas then come back once they've circulated in these kinds of forums and back into academic practice. Third problem, of course, the most obvious and the most debated, closeness to commerce. I think one would have to be kidding oneself if one thought that universities in the past were not, in some sense or the other, close to commerce. Many of them undoubtedly were in all sorts of ways. But in a sense, are they now getting too close? One thinks, for example, of the salutary problems of Enron and of some of the board members of Enron, a series of academics who were invited on and clearly were in part seduced by the money that might have been available given out by that particular company. And then a final twist to these problems is provided by the rise of a new set of intermediaries who are intervening in the knowledge production process in ways which are clearly formative and that they insist that knowledge is seen to perform. And of course, the most obvious example, and I'm thinking here of Michael Powers' work, is the kind of rituals of verification that one finds in terms of the audit society. A whole series of intermediaries coming into existence which themselves audit the outputs of knowledge production. One sees, for example, this happening now in the university sector as a whole series of specialized companies come into existence whose purpose is clearly to audit universities' output of knowledge, to try and measure it in various ways, and so on. One sees it again in the rise of the ethics industry, which in the United States has now become a major commercial enterprise, and which is starting to become that way in the UK as well. So, I'll now conclude by just talking very briefly about the LSE. And what we can see here that I want to argue is that as we've gone on, actually, with this project, I think in many ways we've become rather more favourably inclined in many ways to the LSE than we actually started out. Of course, we were very favourably inclined to it to begin with. But one of the reasons for that, I think, is that we think on the whole, the reason that LSE does get flack is because early on it produced modern methods of marketing of one form or another, which in a sense other universities are only just catching up with. Many of them, in fact, in many ways in their frenzy to market, perhaps even overtaking at this point in time. So do we think there's anything terrible about Demos and LSE in terms of this knowledge production society? No, not really, but let's just mention a couple of problems just in conclusion. One of them, I think, is the problem that the LSE is a metropolitan institution. And that, of course, is its strength in all sorts of ways, but it also means that there's a risk involved. And that risk, I think, is the risk of being captured by the London structure of talk. I would certainly argue that the UK polity still bears many of the marks of its monarchical and colonial past, in the sense that the centre of London, and a very small space in the centre of London, is a location in which much of the political talk of the country goes on, and in which much of what is actually political is reproduced in one form or another. And this is, if you like, a continuing frenzy of talk, nowhere more so, I presume, than at this point in time. And in many ways, the problem with it is precisely implicit within it is a kind of spatial grammar of exclusion. In a sense, it's London interests, in a sense, or what's regarded by that London structure of talk, which dictates what actually is the political agenda in all sorts of ways. One risk for LSE is that it's captured by that London structure of talk, but at the same time, of course, it's also one of the main institutions whereby other areas of Britain even get a look in at all. So that's the first point. The second point, I suppose, is that, to an extent at least, rather like world cities looking down on other cities, the uncomfortable fact is that to some degree LSE has been able to achieve its eminence at the expense of other educational institutions. LSE thinks a lot about toppling Oxford and Cambridge, but it forgets that its elite status, in a sense, relies still on this penumbra of other kinds of institutions. One of the interesting things, I think, about the white paper that's come up is whether, in a sense, it will produce a more collaborative kind of mindset or not. But those are two very mild criticisms to leave with before we move on. And I think I'm exactly right on time.
Nigel, thank you very much. Brilliant, spot on. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, perhaps we could move on then and hear Professor Gregor McLennan talk about ideas and their mediators. Gregor, please.
Can I just begin by thanking the LSE, the directorate, but not just the directorate, all the people who we interviewed, senior staff and others who gave their time. And when we take our kind of roadshow to Demos, we'll be thanking Tom and his colleagues for the more Demos slant of things. But thank you for hosting this event and for hosting the research opportunity. I should say that it's a little bit embarrassing. I mean, this isn't a huge project. In ESRC DOSH terms, it's a tiny project. something like 20 interviews here at the LSE, a similar number at Demos and amongst the wider networks. Quite an amount of, you know, not incredibly specific site observation of various kinds undertaken by Janet Vox and Jacob Arnoldi, our eminent research fellows and assistants. So it's not a huge project. Therefore, our findings as such are not only provisional but pretty small, which is one reason why we keep sticking in a way to the big issues that inform this kind of research. So I'll just give my take on some of the bigger issues that Nigel has touched upon, and then I'll talk a little bit more about LSE mechanisms for the culture of ideas. First of all, the project is concerned with specifically the notion of ideas, and the possibility, in fact, the reality of the way in which ideas have come back to signify something important about the knowledge society. It's not that long ago where knowledge society was about some kind of mechanical notion of knowledge transfer. You dream up something in the labs, even the social sciences labs, you smack it out there into the public domain, someone absorbs it, and a policy outcome pops out the other end. I think even in official government and other documentation and ethos of thinking about knowledge has changed to a much kind of softer way where ideas are accepted for being rather fuzzier. It's a kind of currency that you can't quite pin down, more like the ether in which ideas' personalities move along, influence, and so on. So we're interested in how cultures of that kind of thing are developed. But what are ideas, you might ask, and we ask ourselves this all the time. We operate with a kind of notional model that there's something different about cultures of ideas, indeed the substance of ideas themselves in contemporary society. We have a number of little kind of trademark rhetorical markers for this, which you can take or leave or add to as you will. We tend to think that knowledge and ideas have become more vehicular rather than ultimate. That's to say that ideas are kicked around, pooled around, changed, and even owned according to a kind of logic of attention rather than some kind of declaration of final propositions or some kind of built-up intellectual systems. Vehicular gets you from A to B. You get on the train, but you get off again whenever it suits you. These are instrumental coinages. These ideas are diagnostic rather than predictive. In other words, they're kind of labels and slogans and opportunities to talk and to talk endlessly about the state we're in. A diagnostic series of mechanisms for where we are rather than where society is going to get to in the classical, as it were, modernist notions of the work of ideas in society. Socialism, progress, liberalism, modernization, or whatever. That kind of finality horizon has been taken out of the world of ideas. Ideas tend to operate in the contemporary sphere with a kind of explanatory framework that focuses on meaning richness, which often means substantive vagueness, or as I've put it here, information poverty. In other words, ideas are thrown into the arena or the agora, the marketplace of ideas, where ideas can be floated. There's almost a flotation of ideas, and they don't seem to mean anything terribly specific, but everybody gets something useful out of them. We call that kind of meaning rich, hard to pin down exactly what they mean, but they seem to have something going for them. They're communicative rather than representational. That's to say they're about the business of bringing people together in a communicative style, embodied by the personalities who speak for these ideas, personalities, rather than some abstract notion of the representation of social reality out there, etc. These ideas are transient rather than timeless, and they are inclusive rather than polarizing. You look at a lot of the influential social sciences ideas today, they're about bringing people in a debating fashion under one roof and one house, rather than saying in ideas terms, those are my friends and those are my enemies. The inclusiveness of ideas has shed some of the exclusiveness and polarizing factor of ideologies, if you like. Okay, well, if all that's true, then ideas institutions today are in the business of branding for ideas, where ideas are branded more in terms of the location and ideas' personalities than the substance of the ideas themselves. What has to be got across is a certain sense of the innovativeness of ideas, not necessarily the substance. So if you go to Demos or LSE, you can't exactly pin down what these places represent, which ideas they stick up for, but we do know that these places are innovative. They are at the cutting edge. They set the agenda so that within the marketplace of a flotation of ideas, the distinction of the market leader goes to the ones who are identified with innovation, with movement, with dynamism. I need to move on a little bit myself here, so I'll just begin to move to some of the features that characterize the LSE as a manufactory of ideas, as one of our interviewees put it. What is it about LSE? What are they trying to do to get into this market capture, cutting-edge position of ideas innovators, the place where you immediately think, ah, yes, someone from the LSE rather than someone from another institution? What I've been describing so far is the kind of terrain of ideas that is shared by think tanks like Demos and academic institutions like the LSE. Shared by. We're not saying for a moment that this space of ideas has no more distinction between universities on the one hand and think tanks or commercial organizations or consultancies on the other. We're not saying anything as silly as that. Clearly, universities retain an in-depth research capacity and a kind of career structure for lifetime professionals that think tanks and others can't reproduce. There are also a number of features about the ideas world in general, including but going beyond the university, that are worth mentioning, because I think in the softer ideas culture, things to do with university life have suddenly become more important, sexier even. You can't find a business consultancy that isn't into research, conferences, lectures, seminars. Nigel mentioned this before, the notion of the seminar as the laboratory for hatching new relevant vehicular ideas is everywhere. Everybody buys into it. So there's a sense in which at just the time when policymakers and others are saying, hey, these universities, what are they doing for society? They're kind of forgetting that a lot of society itself has become academicized or universitified, because all these institutions geared up to ideas innovations need the material forms of university life. So if think tanks and universities like LSE share the same kind of idea space, what are some of the specificities of LSE in this context? I won't mention Demos because Tom will cover that today. First of all, there's just one easy contrast that I think we'd want to hold fire on, and that's the notion, this is as much a stereotype about Demos as anything else, this is the notion that Demos are kind of substanceless. They're closely associated with new labor. They come up with flaky ideas and feed them directly into the new labor pot, where they get stirred around, joined up government, rebranding Britain, all that kind of thing. I think this does a disservice to the way in which Demos has changed over the years. We've identified at least three phases of Demos, and that phase was probably only the first one. And in their subsequent phases, they've looked much more like a kind of proper, as it were, ideas culture stimulator, where the idea is not to kind of get notions and plant them straight into Tony Blair or anybody else's head, but rather to kind of inculcate the mechanisms within institutions and user groups for their own production of ideas. So it kind of gets Demos slightly wrong, that stereotype. But it also gets LSE wrong, in a sense, if we take LSE slightly strangely as a typical university in the postmodern age. It gets LSE wrong because LSE itself is actually in some ways better than Demos at getting the ear of government, devising ever so vehicular notions for policy change, constantly being in the media almost for the sake of being in the media, and so on. So that easy contrast is simply not allowable. Now, I'm going to mention about 10 points here of Demos's, of LSE's culture, that each one is rather obvious in a sense. And to the people we interviewed, it will be terribly obvious where we're just repeating back to you your own words. But if LSE is into branding so that it can take its place at the forefront of the new marketplace of ideas, innovation, what does it actually do to achieve this? First of all, its funding regime just simply requires it to be a public and necessarily responsive to sponsors and opportunities and so on, because about 20 years ago, Tony will correct me if I'm wrong, LSE was about 80% publicly funded, and now it's only 20% publicly funded. Another absolutely basic material fact of life referred to already is that, in a sense, the physical space of the LSE is public. It's in the middle of London. People pass through it. It's kind of open to publicity in a way that other institutions aren't. And this is physically encapsulated by things like the little bridge at the top of the library, with the research lab and so on, as it were, opening out the institution to the London that it's necessarily part of. Then there are some activities that are just straightforward, you know, branding activities. There's a public relations officer at the highest level of the institution. There are rather senior journalists who are employed by the LSE at various stages, sometimes in connection with a specific center, sometimes a bit more generally. The use of the logo has been streamlined and distributed across all the publications. The publications themselves, LSE Events, the LSE Magazine, LSE News and Views, even the governor's briefing documents now all have a consistency of tone, almost a consistency of pace, that speaks with the LSE voice. These are just kind of little mechanisms that no doubt up and down the country every other university is trying to do. But LSE have undoubtedly got their act together on this to produce a very uniform appearing brand and logo. In these publications, there is a greater attention to visuals, as befits a kind of visualized postmodern culture, where at every opportunity you either have the wonderful library staircase designed by Foster and partners, again quite a kind of both opening and encompassing structure. The library staircase appears regularly in the publications, and of course, So do pictures of the director with all sorts of famous people who pass through the institution. So at every possible opportunity, there's a way of building some of those just physical points of association into the image. And it wasn't that so long ago since the LSE did not specifically have a kind of photographer, a top-class photographer, for that very purpose. Again, a tiny thing, but an important one. The next point is the way in which there's a voice of innovation within the culture. There's a high-level group for academic innovation. I don't know how many people might know these things. Do you think everybody knows these things?
Probably quite a few, yeah.
The group for academic innovation, there's a futures group. There's, of course, the research lab, which is this marvelous idea of bringing together several of the already well-known research centers into some kind of mega center. And of course, just even to have the word lab there gives it an experimental, novel notion, and also a kind of scientific authority, a lab, you know, not just a bunch of people sitting around on soft chairs, which is actually what it is, to a large extent. Nothing wrong with that. That's how ideas are hatched, but it's people sitting on soft chairs, but when you label it as the research lab, it looks as if that's where ideas literally explode into being. Other things, not only the research lab, but the Fathom Initiative of net-based learning, and where masses of publications of the staff are put on online for people all over the world to look at. And then there was the eLab initiative. I don't know if we've established quite where the eLab's going, but the eLab is another intensely innovatory sounding notion. So the LSE is very much into establishing itself as an internally innovating culture. LSE events are not really LSE events. There's this kind of thing tonight, but you'll all be very aware of the countless, every night there's something going on that is owned by the LSE, but really opened up to a much wider public. So the notion of innovation and the notion of publicity are constant themes in the self-presentation of the brand. The mode of discourse, the kind of way of talking within the institution, seems to me to blur the insider-outsider distinction more than other universities that we're aware of. There's a sense in which, in our interviews with the senior staff especially, the public image of the institution is also the internal image. The number of times people reported back to us that, well, you know, the LSE is better known overseas than the BBC, you know, and you sort of nod and think, what? No, come on. The way in which the senior staff say, you know, if you were a professor elsewhere, you'll maybe be a senior lecturer at the LSE. The way in which people say the LSE is the only place to be at the cutting edge and so on. Now, all these things may well have a degree of truth in them, but when you see the text of the interview stacked up and coming back at you, what is also very clear is a self-belief. And a self-confirmation of the brand that LSE is the ideas manufacturing, and almost to the point where to say, well, is this really true or not? It doesn't really matter. Appointments and keynote figures: Beck, Sennett, Latour, Tony Benn. These are people, are they inside the institution, are they outside the institution? Maybe they were yesterday, maybe they're not today, but they're still here, they're still around. There's Kofi Annan, Bill Clinton, our Bill Clinton. Yes, he'll be back again, etc. There's a sense in which these figures are LSE figures now because of the way in which the publicity, the eventness of the institution and the consolidation of that eventness in reports and photographs and advertisement. And that gives the institution a kind of unparalleled breadth of reference. George Soros pops in regularly. People talk about the way in which these kind of big public names are comfortable and almost associates of the institution itself. The institution has media interface at a very high level. There are the LSE experts list, and the expert list is monitored by the institution to see whether it's being effective. I guess I'll go fast here. There's also policy connections. Each of the units within the LSE have their own access to the media. They have their own networks with politicians, with government agencies, with specific journalists on aspects of policy. And of course, well, this is nothing new in the policy field, especially in the social policy field, a long history of this. And you might want to argue that what we're saying is actually nothing new. The LSE has always been into publicity and public policy and so on. But certainly the way in which what you might call, not big ideas, but kind of quasi-ideas that feed into the policy domain is regular, impressive, and followed up by big hits on the kind of publicity and policy network scenes. Baby bonds, graduate tax, hypothecated tax, housing management structures, important vehicular ideas, things that move problems on in specific areas, come out of the LSE all the time, but they're also consolidated within the external image of what the place is all about. Networking more generally, knowledge is meant to be networked. It's meant to be more horizontally spread than it was before, less hierarchically imbued. And the LSE is very good not only at networking, but almost not having to tell people, they're senior stars anyway, you don't have to tell them that they have to be networkers. It almost comes implicit in the culture that if you're not a networker, you probably wouldn't have got a job here anyway, and you have been appointed because you are a networker. There's a sense in which LSE rides a very impressive line between inculcating networkism and retaining an older image that we just appoint the best people. But of course, the best people tend to be good networkers, good mediators. So that's a self-reinforcing thing there, too. Finally, it's worth thinking of some of the big centers, the main centers within the school as themselves being rather like think tanks. They've got their own press officers, their own circuits, their own networks, their own seminars, and so on, and they operate quite like think tanks. Okay, well, my last point is really to switch back to the general theme, having looked very briefly at LSE mechanisms for the culture of ideas, and to say that what we might be watching here is a move from what Zygmunt, just as for convenience, Zygmunt Bauman's terms of the intellectual as legislator, who hands down tablets of stone for the transformation of society, and you better all buy into it, etc. That move from a legislator to a more careful interpreter, hearing what you're saying kind of person, know where you're coming from, let's all be humble and just translate one's experiences, etc. I think we've now moved into, or at least this is one of the project's kind of suppositions, we've moved into a new image of the intellectual, of the public intellectual, and that's the intellectual as a mediator, someone who brings people together, causes a bit of catalytic movement, and moves things on by coining the kind of ideas that I talked about before. Now here I think it's very important to identify the director of the LSE, Tony Giddens, as one of these mediator intellectuals. Because if you look at Tony's main ideas, and I don't just mean third way or globalization, but you could go back, if he remembers, to structuration theory and the like, where what's being coined is a wonderfully kind of enabling and inclusive umbrella within which people can then continue to have debates, etc. They're inclusive and not polarizing ideas. And if you look at the way he's handled the third way and globalization, this is exactly what happens. He is identified with a kind of copyrighted intellectual space, a kind of vehicular type. And within it, people are then brought together in a mediated way. The third way debate, for instance, includes publications called Against the Third Way. in the global third way debate, there's a whole number of policy suggestions that have more or less nothing to do with the general idea of the third way and so on. But somehow, the third way has colonized a certain way of talking about things that is typical of the way in which these kind of vehicular ideas operate today. Now, I say that for two reasons. One is that in the interviews, a lot of the senior staff were saying, well, of course, don't identify. We think Tony's a great thing and wonderful for the institution, but don't identify us with his notions like the third way and so on. And I wonder whether that can possibly be right. I mean, in a sense, Tony has defined certain spaces where it's almost hard to see how you could be outside them. But it's important in another way, because the LSE seems to be this ideas culture where Tony actually doesn't just lead this ideas culture, he embodies the kind of intellectual mediator that seems so typical of the way in which ideas cultures operate today. And that's significant because, of course, in a sense, the Giddens era is coming to an end. And I think that the coincidence of his leadership and whatever ways you want to describe it on the plus side, but the way in which he exemplifies the culture of ideas today is very important because, of course, as he leaves office, maybe his successor won't be quite that type of person. So that's just a kind of interesting and ironic kind of observation on where things might go from here. Henrietta, I'm sorry I've taken more than my time.
Right? Thank you very much, Gregor, thank you very much. Can I introduce Tom Bentley, who's director of Demos? Tom, please.
Thank you. Yeah. I think I'll stay here.
Yes,
if that's
please
okay.
Do.
And there have been so many ideas, questions, possibilities, directions of conversation introduced already that I won't try to get any kind of coverage. And I will also try and be quite brief. What I'll do, I think, is to try and two or three of the really big issues that I see emerging out of the conversation, and perhaps try and synthesize them in a way that might lead to some useful practical application, since that's one of the things that think tanks are supposed to be able to do. Is there a knowledge or an ideas society around us? Yes, definitely. Do we see the emerging contours of new network-based systems of knowledge production and exchange? Yes, I think we do, although they're partially articulated contours. And I think that it will take a long time, probably a generation, to find out whether or not there are new definitive and settled patterns of institutional character and organization that come to dominate in this new kind of environment. And that's one of the themes that I want to return to. Is everything getting better or worse? Should we be taking seriously the kind of everything flows, nothing really matters concern that comes out of part of the presentation? I don't think that's what you were ending up saying. Well, certainly not everything is necessarily getting worse, although many things have got worse for universities over the last generation. But probably more importantly, I think, for this debate, actually it's impossible to tell in any meaningful or objective sense from generation to generation whether or not the quality of knowledge, its applicability or value to wider society, the depth of understanding in our key institutions is really deteriorating. And to take a kind of microscopic analogy to explain why I think that's true, think about the debates, the public controversies that rage around educational qualifications and the idea of standards and the, as far as I know, very well verified by academic research finding that actually when you try and compare, for example, A-level papers today with those taken in the 50s, the answer is you're not comparing like with like. Not only as the kind of mode of the question setting and the range of cognitive and metacognitive skills as well as factual knowledge being tested, changed, but actually the socioeconomic and the cultural context surrounding the pupils has changed so much that it's very difficult to come to any objective assessment. And I think that leaves us in quite a difficult position because what it means is that there are, in the kind of knowledge, under the Knowledge Society bracket, there are a whole series of different hairs racing off in different directions that is very difficult to keep track of, let alone to kind of corral into any coherent destination. Demos was founded 10 years ago this year with the humble and modest ambition of becoming the first political think tank for the 21st century. And if you look at its original founding statement, which I wasn't party to the writing of, I was a humble undergraduate at the time, it made a series of claims. First of all, that the best in the life of ideas had become dangerously disconnected from mainstream political practice and institutional life. And second, that in order to become the first political think tank for the 21st century, Demos will be structured around a series of networks rather than the conventional think tank model of a small, tight hierarchy with a guru sitting at the top or in the centre of it. And I think that over those 10 years, as Gregor said, in different phases, we have played with, experimented with, and sometimes had significant influence with particular applications of both of those principles. And where we've ended up is with the need to continuously try to generate, refine, and learn from new modes and models of knowledge production and exchange and learning. And secondly, crucially, to focus not on the mobilizing ideas of politics in the conventional sense, but much more on the contours and the dynamics of more deep-seated institutional change. And I think that may be one of the critical issues that we could have some conversation about. It is true that with the collapse of polarized ideologies, the shift beyond left and right, we have ended up in a situation where mainstream political debate and decision-making have become sequential. And that for most institutions, but particularly those concerned with politics and public policy, part of the competition now is to get to the next place first. And there is a very interesting question about how that next place, the destination, the next alighting point, is shaped by the wider processes. But that doesn't automatically mean that all that matters is the process, that it's somehow become a kind of empty shell from which all substantive moral or empirical or ideological concerns have been drained. What it means is that the process of trying to achieve both coherent and robust conceptual frameworks, resilient empirical policies and strategies for implementation, and what synthetic moral positions that have a wider resonance and are likely to command serious public support over long times, it's become a much more difficult and fragmented process. I was very struck, though, by listening to the presentation, by how many of the key ideas and some of the authors, including Michael Power and Zygmunt Bauman, mentioned in the course of this tour had actually been Demos authors, writing on specific topics and kind of adding to the cumulative output of this miniature ideas factory. And I think it's absolutely right, as Gregor implied, that the most interesting, but perhaps the most difficult task is to try and look in organizations like this, and Demos is certainly not the only one, for the emergent patterns, for the kind of cumulative weight and impact of themes and ideas and iterations that find themselves becoming more or less constant and developing coherently over long periods of time. Those themes are not always obvious. Sometimes you pick up clues about them, even when you're in the midst of the sequential process, for example, editing pamphlet after pamphlet as it comes out. But where the big synthetic themes are is one of the big questions that we have to ask. Two things that I want to close with, which I think are open challenges, really. The first is that it's true that institutionally, universities and other education institutions are having a huge and kind of often unrecognized influence on the way that the rest of the knowledge society, the businesses, the voluntary organizations, the public policymakers, and so on, try to find ways of exchanging this knowledge. and actually the problem of transfer, of getting things meaningfully from one location to another, and retaining their integrity and the reason why you wanted to transplant them in the first place, I think is much more fundamental and pressing problem for whole societies than the problem of production or origination in that sense. But it is true that everyone's, you know, every major institution has got its own think tank these days, more or less. And it's also true that everyone's doing seminars and masterclasses, that electronic networks give new economies of scale to these formats and these methods of transfer. But it's also true that those methods, despite the fact that many of them go back into ancient academic and intellectual traditions, are actually highly constrained themselves. That in many ways, universities, while they're preoccupied with the inherent worth of knowledge and with maintaining scholastic disciplines and traditions, are industrially organized institutions. And Labour's current higher education policy in this country is a further industrialization in many senses, mainly because of the way that it presses for even kind of higher volume processing of undergraduate talent. These formats, the methods of exchange that institutions rely on, that we're relying on now, are often not the ones that lead to greater, wider understanding, greater theoretical clarity, or the best possible synthesis of empirical evidence. And one of the things that Demos does, in particular contexts, is continuously to look for new ways of exchanging. So, for example, we've just established a weblog called Demos Greenhouse as one way of keeping our kind of fairly varied and highly distributed network of interested users and participants in touch with the things that we're thinking about and talking about. We have become highly practiced in holding, I don't know about transdisciplinary, but certainly interdisciplinary conversations. And there is a particular set of skills, as Tony knows well, involved in bringing together people from very different theoretical disciplinary backgrounds, sometimes from different cultures and countries, to have a coherent conversation about the same set of questions. And perhaps most importantly, so I could talk in more detail about that kind of experimentation with new approaches to organizational learning and dialogic spaces and so on, but I won't go into any more detail. But I think perhaps most importantly, what we found ourselves addressing across the whole range of subjects that we publish on, think about, try to influence public policy on, is the relationship between institutional policy and social practice itself. Actually, both institutions and governments are structured on particular theories of knowledge and always have been. And the quotation that you started with, which included the idea that businessmen and other professional men pick up their facts bit by bit, is a very powerful illustration of the extent to which kind of social theories and constructions of knowledge have always conditioned institutional form and therefore what it's possible to do both within and beyond those institutions. We focus on what's out there in the public debate, what the next big idea is, who's generating the mobilizing ideas. But we focus far too little on whether or not the institutional frameworks that we live in and maintain through our everyday behavior actually make it possible for these kinds of ideas to take root, to change the distribution of power, the formation of social affiliation and identity, the capabilities of various kinds of institutions in different sectors. And questioning the routes by which ideas find their way into practice, which means looking at far more than just how governments form their policy, but also, as we do, at the restructuring of voluntary organizations, the networking of community-based inclusion groups, and so on and so on, and particularly at new approaches to public involvement and deliberation, requires a willingness to take the knowledge out of whatever institutional box it originated it from. And I think, kind of coming back to the list of starting questions, that while things have not been entirely negative for universities, and in many ways the LSE has been something of a trailblazer in pointing the way for the whole of the rest of the sector towards a new form of intellectual independence, a new form of kind of enterprising political and financial autonomy, and a new place in a newly interdependent international culture of ideas and political exchange. That if universities are going to be leaders in the debate about the proper role of ideas in society and the ways in which we should understand knowledge, then they have to face up themselves to the scale and the depth of the institutional challenge that they face in practice. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Tom, very much indeed. So we've come to the end of our interventions, and Tony, I think, is going to conclude in some way or other.
Am I?
Yes, well, I hope so.
Well, time is passing. I'd better keep it, I think, fairly short, really. I mean, can I thank my three co-panelists for coming here? I think the ideas involved in this are genuinely interesting, as Tom just said. I'd also like to thank Denise and Judith for organising the event. Now, who are Denise and Judith? Well, Denise and Judith, one is the head of PR and the other is plays a major role in promotion of the LSE. So this event is a kind of example of what it's about, because it was to some extent designed as a promotional event. So, I mean, these things do tend to elide, I think, as the LSE is organised in terms of intellectual events, which it has. Let me just buzz quickly through a few points. First of all, I think most of the discussion makes me in some way a bit more traditionalist than I would otherwise be, I think, because it leads me more to think of certainly big changes going on in the LSE, but the university retains many of its core strengths, which actually do go quite a long time back, long way back. I would define the LSE today as essentially a privately funded public institution. That's certainly a change for the reasons Nigel noted. When, for example, when Ralph Dahndorf was the head of the LSE, 75% of its funding came from the state, as was mentioned. Now 20% of the LSE's funding comes directly from the state. All the rest has to be achieved. So it forces the LSE, I think, to be much more dynamic than it would otherwise be. But of course, it exposes the LSE to the very pressures that were talked about. And these pressures are now global. I mean, the LSE has to compete on a global market to get top-class faculty and to attract the best students we can from across the world. But I would say what makes the LSE what it is, and what I've tried to emphasize since I've been here, are quite traditional things, actually. First, caliber of the faculty. LSE lives or dies by the intellectual strength and especially the research output of its faculty, because that determines how people see the LSE in the kind of global hierarchy of universities. And second, intensity of debate. Since I've been here, I've tried extremely hard to get really intense intellectual and policy-making debate with an interface with the outside world. But that is a kind of continuation of what the LSE has always stood for. I mean, we've been very proactive about it, but I think the LSE for a long time has quite rightly stood for that kind of engaged, active, intense intellectual atmosphere. Second, I would stress the LSE is not a typical university, and therefore it's a mistake to treat it as such. It's essentially a niche institution. It's a social science-based institution. It doesn't have a range of art subjects, and it doesn't, of course, have any natural science subjects. This has always given it a slightly different character from most other universities. Yes, we're very conscious of the LSE's brand name, but to me, a brand name is not a commercial thing. A brand name is essentially a means of generating trust mechanisms, whether it's in a university or a business. A brand is something you trust, you can rely on. The thing that we've found about the LSE brand name is that it does have to be defined in relation to Oxford and Cambridge, as was mentioned, because of the hold of Oxbridge over British culture. So we've been proactively trying to improve the brand of the LSE within the UK, but it also needs continual refurbishment around the world. A brand name is not a static thing. You have to work at it all the time. We've been trying to extend the LSE brand name, as it were, into markets which the LSE was not in before, especially, for example, Latin America. It was very closely linked to a kind of imperial heritage, the LSE, in terms of students coming from Asia and whatnot, but we now want to have a much more global student body than we had in the past. Yes, the relationship to the media is crucial in all of this. this is because of some of the changes that have been mentioned. The media no longer report upon how our society is. They actually constitute large chunks of what that society is like, and that change is visible in politics and in many other areas. Who is the first person a politician is responsible to every morning? Well, it's not really Parliament, it's the Today program or other media outlets. You can obviously oversimplify this, but this is a different relationship from the past. Some think tanks anyway step into this area. I mean, some continental writers on media have actually spoken of government by think tanks, and it's certainly true that some of the people who've been in think tanks like Demos, like Jeff Mulgan, one of the founders of Demos, have now very powerful positions in government, and those positions are not elected positions. There is a kind of conduit from think tanks into government. There's a kind of direct relationship to government, which is certainly in some respects anyway different from what existed before. And it is also obvious, I think, that there is a much more active interface between universities and the wider world in the production of social science knowledge anyway. So in the old days, for example, the Guardian was one bit of newspaper. It never had the second bit. The second bit, second Guardian lifestyle section, whatever it's called, is essentially a sociological text, you know. And almost every newspaper has that kind of sociological text today. So it's certainly true that universities have lost some of the monopoly they used to have over knowledge production. But nevertheless, they still, to my mind, dominate it because they produce knowledge rather than information. I mean, universities supply the research on which most of the other debates that go on are based, and have to do so, and have to continue to do so. On the third way issue, well, I would emphasize very strongly what you said some members of staff said, because I would say that myself. Third way debate, insofar as I've been involved in it, is something to do with me, not with the LSE. And there's no sense in which I would try to generalize my views to the whole of the LSE. The LSE must represent all political positions. It must represent all intellectual positions too. Would be no sense at all in which I would try to impose any particular political stance on the LSE. However, this I would say, many people I think have completely misunderstood the origins of New Labour and what was going on in the ascent of New Labour to power, because it's so conventional to say that New Labour was kind of all soundbite and was just a kind of media invention. Whereas I would say the opposite. I would say what we were working on, those of us involved in this kind of project, not just filtered through universities, but involved in these debates from the late 1980s onwards, was, and this Demos is a material example of this, because Demos came from Marxism Today, to some extent, where Marxism Today found itself without a project. We were looking at how you respond to the big social changes going on in the world. And I think that the debate about those social changes, the backdrop of the British Labour Party, and to some extent American New Democrats, was well in advance of most other countries at that time. We were among the first to see the true impact of globalization. I mean, people didn't even use the term globalization in the mid-1980s. If you're talking about terms that penetrated popular discourse, globalization would be one of the most powerful examples, I think, of that. Second, the knowledge economy itself. At that time, most people didn't believe there was a knowledge economy. But there is, because 40% of the population used to work in manufacture. Now 16% work in manufacture, and that proportion is dropping. So over 80% of the population have to get their livelihood from symbolic or service skills of one type or another. That completely changes the context within which left of center parties operate. Finally, the rise of individualism is sort of connected to reflexive nature of modern societies, because what we thought and what I still think is that modern societies are characterized by the retreat of custom, tradition, and habit from people's lives, so that people have to live much more open, reflective lives than they ever did in the past. It doesn't follow they all behave like intellectuals, but we call this clever citizens, not meaning by this that people are intellectually necessarily clever, but that you must engage with a much more shifting environment of knowledge than people ever did in the past. And this has sort of obvious concrete consequences. For example, process of de-alignment in politics. Large majority of people used to have political affiliations that are pretty stable in most industrial countries. Now, most people don't. Well over 50% of the population of most industrial societies today say they are neither on the right or the left, and they don't necessarily vote for a political party on one electoral occasion because they voted for that party before. So all these changes have to be engaged with, that's true, but I suppose it leaves me thinking universities still must sustain many traditional things they always did. Production of reliable knowledge, really good, outstanding faculty, a kind of, to some extent, insulated environment. I mean, I like people at the LSE to engage in the media. I like that. But I no means expect all the academic staff to do that, nor do I think it's desirable they should do. You must, to some extent, have a sheltered environment where you're producing, whatever you said in the beginning, imagination, and where you pursue intellectual life autonomously, not in relation to any vocational needs from the outside world. So while there are all these new pressures, I think a lot in universities is still driven by something probably closer to the traditional role of university systems, even niche systems like the LSE, than are implied in at least some of this discussion. So now I presume we have a bit of time for open public debate on these issues.
Yeah, we do. So can we open up debate to the floor? There are roving mics going around, so if you'd like to raise a question, please do.
If you'd like to stay, please do. Or if you'd like to go, please do.
Right, it's one there at the back.
Yes, I am Benedetta Rossi of the Anthropology Department, and I felt a bit puzzled about the presentation of the researchers, because having been in this place for 9 years of my life, I didn't really recognize it in the descriptions that were provided. It seems to me that the LSE was presented as a place where there's no culture of ideas, but there are ideas without culture. It seems to me that it's been presented as a place where people have great self-belief, but their ideas are devoid of substance. And thirdly, the LSE intellectual seem to be embodied by the figure of the mediator, which is almost good at selling itself, at selling its appearance. And this evokes an image of almost a high-class prostitute which engages in a short-term relations with big names, such as Kofi Annan, Clinton, etc., but people who do not stay. And what's happening here was presented almost as, again, devoid of substance and ephemeral. Well, but this is not what has kept me here for 9 years, and my experience may be peculiar on this. And I wanted to emphasize two aspects that I think were not really part of the presentation. One is, it seems to me that the diversity within LSE is what I really prized for a very long time. And I'm talking about diversity in the student body and amongst the staff. Rather than defending conservatively one or few solidified positions, that is what may have been referred to as polarity in some institutions that LSE does not have. LSE prizes diversity of people, of ideas, of approaches. And this requires respect of difference and being good networkers. It requires being able to translate your ideas to people who think differently, who come from different backgrounds, different cultures, different societies. In my classes, there's constantly students from many different continents. And when I studied here, my professors came from different contexts. This diversity, to me, turns into spaces of cross-fertilization between high-caliber thinkers, including, and I'm thinking of spaces very diverse, ad hoc small interstices, like seminars, like lunch in the brunch bowl, like tutorials with brilliant students, like at the end of a seminar like this, after is followed by some event in the underground where some big names, professors like Robert Wade, are going to play classic guitar, and after which maybe we'll all go for a drink and exchange our views, which are sometimes very different. But this is what has kept me here, the caliber of the people that I have been able to meet, including, again, the student body.
Benedetta.
Yeah. Now, the second point,
quickly,
and the last
extremely
one,
quickly, yeah,
is that I think the engagement with contemporary social problems outside the LSE gives a sense of relevance of one's work to real problems that exist in the world, and it may be perceived as valuable. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we'll just take another question here first and build up a portfolio.
I'm Doran Cummings. I'm from the Institute of Ideas, which is not a think tank, I suppose. There was a striking difference between any university and any think tank is that universities are involved in teaching and think tanks aren't. And I wanted to raise that because in discussions about universities now, it is often discussed as if it's a conflict between teaching and research, that academics resent the fact that they have to teach when they want to be doing their own work. And there's some discussion about the separating the two, having a two-tier system with the research universities and their teaching universities. I think this idea of a conflict does rest in a particular model of knowledge, perhaps, what Gregor MacLennan was talking about, is vehicular knowledge. I think I'm slightly suspicious of the whole idea of knowledge on the model of production, the idea of knowledge creation. I don't know if that it really is what people are doing, but people tend to talk about research because it sounds like real work. But, you know, research in common usage means gathering information, and a lot of academic research isn't research in that sense. It's actually thinking and writing, and I think maybe universities are a bit defensive about that. So I wonder if people could comment on whether there is a necessary conflict between teaching and research, and whether it's maybe a different way of thinking about knowledge.
Thank you, thank you. I think we have a question down here in the front. Yeah.
I think that the academic establishment has failed in a big way on the question of the theory of democracy. We haven't got time to go into why, but I can just demonstrate that by pointing out that most people here don't know what the word sortition means, which is a concrete world historical concept, but they do know what the word globalization means, which the nicest thing I can say about that is that it's fashionable, right? So I know that Tom Bentley knows what sortition means, so perhaps you could explain why most people here don't know what sortition means.
Okay. Now, do we have another question, or are we... Shall we ask for a little bit of response from our panel, then? Would you like that? Yeah? Nigel, do you want to say something on behalf of the researchers, or do a characterization of the LSE as a...
Yes, I'll...
...thoughtless institution?
Say something,
yeah?
As well. I think we felt all along that we're susceptible to exactly the kind of criticism that is being made over there. And I think in some senses it's fair enough. And yet in some ways, you know, one of the things I think there's a tension about is that LSE is clearly in a sense, in certain senses, a very traditional kind of university institution. And yet at the same time, it is in certain senses quite different. And the problem we faced is how to, in a sense, put our finger on what those differences are. And we believe that some of those differences are some of the things that we've actually talked about. That doesn't mean that some of the traditional university activities aren't still going on in some way or other. That would be absurd to say. One of the other things I think that's important and perhaps makes a difference and that we don't stress or haven't stressed in the presentation is the fact of how many postgraduates there are in the place from a large number of different kinds of cultures. And I think that, if you like, adds to the kinds of things you're actually saying. One of the things that strikes me then is how you then get a parallel with a lot of US Ivy League universities, where you see the same kind of thing. Very diverse culturally postgraduate population, though not so much an undergraduate population. The other thing I'd just like to say is one has to be careful. Lots of things nowadays are fashionable. Doesn't mean by any means that they're therefore bad. And one has to be, I think, extremely careful not to read the one off onto the other in all sorts of ways, which is, I think, routinely done currently, and I think is actually quite dangerous. For example, if you even think in terms of management theory, there are probably all sorts of things which are fashionable, but that doesn't mean they're absolute rubbish, and one has to be, I think, very careful to try and make that kind of equation. I should shut up and...
Yeah, thank you. Gregor, do you want to make a short intervention there?
Well, only just mainly in relation to the point from the back there, where, you know, the object of the study was not to, as it were, give a representative picture of the institution. We would have had to ask for about £1 million more than we did to get that. I mean, you know, the point was fair enough, and we'll take it on board. I think really what we're trying to focus on is that in some ways, the obvious kind of things to say, such as what you're saying, you know, everybody sort of knows that before research even starts. And the same point down here that, you know, universities do teaching, think tanks don't. A university like LSE has always been extraordinarily diverse, etc. A lot of other universities are extraordinarily diverse. I mean, that's the kind of route that says, well, look, clearly there's no difference whatsoever between, there's no similarity whatsoever between, as it were, a place like this and some other kind of outfit. And that's, you know, I absolutely agree with that. But then that tends to lead you to kind of overlook some of the tendencies, especially within the kind of dominant self-images of the institution that do suggest a slightly different terrain and publicity of academic production of ideas that are blending into all sorts of other types. So we're just trying to be kind of rather descriptive about that. It's quite striking to see how, at least in the interviews with a range of senior staff, one tends to get questions and movements that are on top of those traditional distinctions that you know, you're saying quite rightly still exist.
Tom, are our two institutions joined by their thoughtlessness? Do you want to come back?
I hope not. I mean, the teaching learning question is very interesting, and partly for me relates back to the point I was trying to make about institutional form and function. Think tanks don't do teaching in the formal sense that you would understand of a university, but we hold seminars and I talk at them and chair them. We give tutorials of a kind. We're engaged in trying to learn from each other and kind of support the development of various intellectual and cognitive disciplines in order to do our work. We give lectures and presentations. And our core activity, as I kind of implied, is more and more is looking for ways to facilitate and stimulate learning. Now, there are clear differences between learning and teaching, although they're obviously bound up with each other, or at least you hope that they are. And at the same time, while we do all of those things, we don't do it within a settled disciplinary or institutional structure. And I would never claim equivalence with the rigors or some of the accountabilities of academic life. But, you know, there is a fundamental problem which may kind of link to this latter point about thoughtlessness, that disciplinary structures can't cope with the complexity and diversity of the world as we increasingly find it. And one of the things that is needed to bring that together is conversation, which is partly why some kinds of umbrella concepts, globalization being a good example, turn out to be very powerful common denominators in the search for meaningful combinations. Does that make them automatically empty and worthless? No.
Thank you. So, Tenny, can ideas change the world?
Well, I think the best thing about the LSE is just brilliant intellectual environment. So that's what I stressed in my comments. It's the best intellectual environment to be in the social sciences, in my view, because it simply has a really high concentration of research-active social scientists. And it does have more diversity than other places on the level of both the faculty and the student body. I mean, 60% of the students come from overseas, the highest proportion of any UK or, I think, European university. And what is not so well known is that over 50% of the younger staff come from not from the UK. So you do have more intrinsic diversity, but it's just a very, very lively intellectual environment, although I'm not sure it's been so lively tonight as it often is. But that, to me, that's its greatest feature, really. I mean, the teaching question is a really interesting one, more complex than one might imagine, because essentially LSE gets its status from its research. That is true of all the so-called research universities. That's what gives LSE degrees their value primarily, and that's what gives LSE its status in the various hierarchies of universities. And when you want to hire people in, you want to get the best people who are doing the best research. But often they won't do much teaching, and you can't get them to come if you try to force them to do more teaching than they want to do. In some American universities, this has gone so far that some of the senior faculty never ever see a student because they're always got buyouts and sabbaticals, and all the on-the-ground teaching is done by teaching assistants who are essentially research students. I mean, we tried to hold the line on that in the LSE and try to make sure that all faculty are involved in teaching, have a lot of contact with students, but there are continual dilemmas on that borderline for all research-based universities because of the global nature of competition for academic faculty that I mentioned earlier. Finally, you know, talking about globalization is not just a fashionable thing. I mean, there's absolutely fundamental changes, at least in my opinion, going on in the nature of the world, which the LSE must be at the forefront of. And certainly since I've been here, even though I hope not in any way tried to foist any particular personal agenda on the LSE, I've tried to make sure the LSE is the forefront of the major intellectual debates of the moment. Discussion of globalization is certainly one of those debates, but only one among many others which are represented here.
Right, well, I'm afraid we do have to stop since it's 7:30. Thank you all very much. I've enjoyed this debate on the culture ideas. Please, will you join me in thanking the panelists for coming to talk to us?